Well, it's just 2 weeks until governments meet to review progress on efforts to fight climate change. And this morning we'll look at what New Zealand businesses are doing to invest in climate action. The Climate Leaders Coalition was formed 3 years ago with 60 signatories and now has 105. Together they account for almost 60% of New Zealand's gross emissions, around 38% of GDP, and employ almost 220,000 people. The coalition has today released its third anniversary snapshot report, which shows its signatories have committed to invest $9.5 billion over the next 5 years to reduce emissions from their businesses. The snapshot report also looks at the individual and collective progress in delivering on these commitments. And to discuss that, we welcome convener Mike Bennetts, who is Chief Executive of Zed Energy. Kia ora, Mike.
Atamarie, Catherine.
And tēnā koe, and welcome to Jolie Hodson, who is a steering group member and also the Chief Executive of Spark. Kia ora, welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine.
Kia ora, kōrua. All right, let's look at some of the headlines out of this year's snapshot. Mike, if you could lead off and just come and go as you wish, each of you. $9.5 billion over 5 years sounds like a lot of money. Does it go far enough, fast enough? And is a commitment to invest good enough right now?
Well, I think the commitment to invest is really, really important. I think that is certainly these companies, our membership, are signalling to government, their customers and the broader stakeholder community that they are up for the change that is necessary and they're putting their money where their mouth is. I think it's until we actually finalise things like the emissions reduction budgets and the plans that the government have around that, that's where I think we get to find the really nice sweet spot between businesses' individual ambitions and what the country needs to achieve, and then we'll be able to see whether there is a gap or not, or yeah, what's the trajectory we need to be working off.
So when you see that big headline figure, what does it break down to? In the absence, as you say, of details on things like the emissions reduction budgets, currently what is that $9.5 billion allocated to?
I think if you look at that $9.5 billion investment, it covers areas like things like transport, so reducing or replacing fleets, investing in new charging infrastructure, looking at our industrial process heat reduction through energy efficiency and phase out of non-renewables. You would have seen some of the announcements around renewable energy, so geothermal and other programs, and then looking at things like trials, methane, investment in R&D to understand how we create more practical solutions on farm and other things. So it's across a wide range of the businesses involved in the CLC.
And so when you talk about those renewable energy investments, that's the big power companies making investments specifically in renewables.
Yes.
Which is already planned to meet electricity demand, right? Because we know we're going to get rising electricity demand. So that investment, any investment that can be argued will reduce emissions relative to the way we do things now, is included in that figure.
Yes, so if you think about geothermal, so Contact recently announced that. Think about our emissions as a business, so Spark's emissions, around 80% of our scope 1, scope 2 are energy. So anything that's done in terms of helping to transition to renewables helps improve that emissions immediately. So I think those long-term investments are really important in ensuring New Zealand can meet our obligations.
There's another figure I'll get to explain it further then. $750 million spent investing in developing products or services to reduce end-user emissions over the next 5 years. What does that refer to, please?
Thinking about...
Yeah, it's good for me to speak to that, as Zed being an example of that. So, you know, clearly we currently sell fossil fuels. So if we were to invest, indeed we have plans to invest in scaling up our biodiesel capacity, that would be an example of a scope 3 emission. So it's tied specifically to the products or services that a company like Zed would sell to our customers, which is different to the $9.5 billion, which is really invested and companies reducing their own operational emissions. So it's about the products that companies sell and the investment going into that to reduce what will eventually be a scope 1, scope 2 emission for the customer itself.
And that's hard yards, especially, isn't it, for a petrol company? Because it's your main product is right at the heart of transport emissions. So we've talked previously, Mike, about the gains you've made operationally, whether it be your own kind of the way staff work or the way logistics work or the vehicles you use or whatever. But the actual product itself is your core contribution to emissions. Under this particular category, you're looking at switching to a lower emitting fuel, say, or into a biofuel, and that therefore counts as a new a replacement to product.
Yeah, correct. That Z's activity would be covered by that $750 million, and across the rest of our membership, there are other companies who are equally investing in their products and their services that will ultimately reduce the emissions from those when they get used by a customer.
It shows how difficult it is in some ways, doesn't it? Because the really big dollars we're seeing are around operations and energy sources, and the harder to crack nut is the core product or service itself for many of these industries. For example, airlines, who we're going to be talking to at 9:30. That's the really hard nut to crack.
Yeah, that's correct. Although if I wanted to make it a little bit more circular, that, you know, if you like, Z's Scope 3 emissions are our customers' Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions.
Just explain the scopes, just for those not so familiar with the details of climate policy. Just explain what the different scopes represent.
Yeah, sure. It's probably good to lump Scope 1 and 2 together. So these are the emissions that are owned or controlled by a company directly or indirectly. And Scope 3 emissions are the other indirect emissions. The way that I think about it is that Z running its business is largely in Scope 1 and Scope 2, but the impact of the products we sell is really our Scope 3, but in turn becomes our customers' Scope 1 and Scope 2, because if you took Air New Zealand as the example, we sell them fuel, we would record that as a Scope 3 emission. They, when they use that fuel, would classify that as a Scope 1 emission.
Right. Let's have a look at some of the snapshot results. Only half of the signatories, or perhaps a half is a lot, but either way, it depends how you look at it. Half the signatories have actually reduced emissions. Does that mean the other half have increased, held steady? And if it's either of the latter, what are the factors in that?
I think if you look at the signatories, there are a component that have held steady and there are a component that have grown. When you look at, if I use us for example, on in terms of our energy emissions, because it was a dry hydro year would be a better way of putting that, we saw an increase in our electricity emissions per unit because of that, because other forms of electricity, non-renewables, were used to ensure we could meet demand. That meant that we had an increase, but elsewhere we reduced our own actions to remove energy efficiency. But when you look at the total picture of that, because of that input, we had a growth. So I think that's why you can see some of these long-term investments that are being laid down now and talked about in that plan ahead, and the commitment that business is making to action are really important to help change the impacts we're seeing.
And how big a role is energy playing in all of this? There's a couple of factors at play. One is population growth, but the other is the fact that as we do more and more online, energy use goes up significantly. And is that a factor for many of these big industries? Their energy needs are overwhelmingly their greatest challenge.
I think energy is a big component of emissions, about 26% energy and industry together, I think, when you look at that. But then there's a requirement on us as business. For example, if I look at our business, one of the areas we're very focused on is removing legacy technology, which uses higher sources of energy, and replacing that with more up-to-date. And that's part of the role that we're taking. We also have, if you think about some of the tools that we use, they also replace collaboration tools, things like Zoom that we're on today, you know, do replace also the movement. So there are pluses and minuses in that. That's why it is, businesses really need to take a good look at every element of how they operate, and not only what they're doing, but also, to Mike's point around customers, but also our supply chain and how we think about that. So our focus in terms of our science-based reduction target is not only about what we will do, but also how we work with our suppliers to reduce our emissions.
So energy is a big one. Transport is another big one. And have we seen much movement there when it comes to reductions?
I think we probably haven't seen the Well, so the answer is yes. Some of it would be affected by COVID. So if you think about it from the perspective of people flying, whether domestically or certainly internationally, that's a lot less over, say, the last 12 months than it was, you know, in the 12 months prior to that. And then even, you know, the experiences we have during lockdowns where people, many people are working from home. Even though lockdowns finish, some people migrate back to work, while others still, as Jolie mentioned, continue to change those work practices such that they continue to work from home for part or whole of the week. So overall, transport is a big issue in New Zealand. We move a lot of goods around the country, both imports and exports, through transport. And the more goods we're moving is driving up the requirement for transport, which is really why we do need to have the alternatives to fossil fuels by way of, you know, renewables like a biofuel, a hydrogen, or indeed electrons, which is the thing that's most commonly spoken about in the transport sector.
Being hydrogen as an option?
Yeah, hydrogen is. It can be used in two forms. As you mentioned earlier, in New Zealand are considering the use of hydrogen as an aviation fuel. Hydrogen also does become much more practical for powering heavy trucks. By the time you, under current technology, by the time you put a big load of batteries into a truck to drive it the distance you want, actually you can't have any additional weight put on by way of the goods that you're trying to transport. So hydrogen looks like it's a potential solution perhaps in 5 to 10 years' time for the heavy transport. And of course, you do have very large companies like Toyota, for example, that are exploring fuel cell electric vehicles, which is effectively taking hydrogen and then converting it into electricity inside the vehicle.
When you look at the challenges facing agriculture as well, with methane emissions, a particular focus at Glasgow, I know scientists in New Zealand argue a different case for methane. This is the classic argument of it being a shorter-lived gas, but damaging while it's here. The scientists who back farmers here on this question make the point that this heavy focus on methane now risks taking the pedal off the carbon emissions, which hang around for 200 years. No matter how you look at it, globally the pressure is coming on over methane emissions. When you look at the challenges facing agriculture, does it feel to each of you like we are still nibbling around the edges, maybe significantly, but for many of your members, you're still nibbling around the edges relative to the kind of cuts we're told are needed to gross emissions by 2030?
Yeah, I think that's a really good example of what I'd call a portfolio effect. So across all of our members, they're all at different stages of their journey. And agriculture, I think, is a great example of where effectively the big change that's needed will come through a technology breakthrough. You could say that transport has got part of a solution there already, given that, say, electricity can go into electric vehicles. So there is a technology solution today for transport that did not exist perhaps a decade or two ago. I think agriculture, as I said, is a great example of where the big change that's needed will probably come from some form of technology innovation, which is where we support and applaud our members for actually investing in the necessary R&D to create that technology breakthrough that could then be applied. Whereas, say, for companies, they could be electrifying their fleet of vehicles today because that's an existing technology, albeit that it comes at a premium to an internal combustion engine.
In the other area, we're seeing, if you look at the use of technology to address kind of environmental challenges, global research shows that digital technology can enable an estimated 20% of the emissions reduction required by 2030. So if you think about things like Internet of Things and whether that's water sensors, energy usage, whether that's looking at other solutions to the point of water pollutants, and that is an opportunity. And already we see through our own business in the areas that we are selling that pretty much 50% of that addresses various forms of climate change or emission reduction programs. So I think the thing as we look ahead is technology will continue to evolve. And the question or the thing that we need to keep front of mind is how do we make sure that we are leveraging that as best as we can to help accelerate the plans that we need to do, and not just relying on what we know today.
The problem is that everyone's been holding out for technology to resolve this crisis for 10, 20, 30 years, and some of these technologies still feel a distance away. Go ahead, Jolie.
I was just going to say, I think that's true to some extent, but when you think about, for example, Internet of Things, that is in market today and is being used, whether that's around water salinity, the quality. So I think the plans that you've seen put forward, both by the Climate Change Commission and others, do focus on technology that's in place right now. The point I'm making is it continues to evolve quickly, and we'd want to make sure that we've got our eye to that future so that we're looking at all of the ways that we can invest smartly to be able to reduce those emissions.
On that point of tech, though, Jolie, the amount of energy that these data centres are requiring as we do more and more in the cloud, to what extent is it negating some of the gains of what it's avoiding doing? Do you understand the question?
I do understand. And part of our plan ahead and our science-based reduction is to getting to our 56% reduction is reduction in data centre. And that's around investment in new data centre capability, both from energy efficient and the way the cooling systems. So I think we are looking at this a very holistic approach in terms of that as part of our sort of scope one, scope two emissions that we need to reduce. So part of that's about renewals, but part of it's about the technology that we're using to create these new tools. So I think you have to look at the whole system. Your point is that you can't just look at one element of it. And I think we are in terms of the way we're setting targets and the reduction plans we have in place.
On the question of the infantries and their being verified, 75% of signatories have had their emissions infantry independently verified, 25% haven't. Do they feel like they don't have a good enough story to tell yet? Mike?
No, I don't think so. I view this in the context of progress. If you are very new to, say, the coalition and new to the processes and the assurance that we look for, there's actually quite a lot you've got to put in place. And clearly you need to have integrity around whatever commitments you make. So I think companies are on a journey. I would expect that 75% to potentially be 100% of the existing members, say, in a year's time, because you do need to have recording mechanisms to a level that may be beyond what you were currently operating to. So in other words, you might have had a really strong commitment around stuff. You were recording things in a way that you thought demonstrated that commitment. But when you actually have to have it independently verified, it could be that the standard required is above what you were working at, and you just need to gather more data.
I think it also reflects the transition. So we're one of those examples where is it June, when the survey was cut off, we hadn't completed that process. But by August, when we released our financial results, we had both the science-based target and it verified. So I think it's really reflective of the change that's going on right now.
30 signatories have signed up to your 2019 statement that had a more ambitious target of trying to reduce emissions to within 1.5 degrees warming in century relative to industrial, which is the more ambitious, but which is also seen as being the goal that will avert the worst consequences of climate change. What's holding others back from joining that ambition?
I think it essentially comes down to integrity. It's very easy for chief executives to make a commitment that would be measured perhaps in a decade's time, because that chief executive may not be there to be accountable for it. So what I think we're finding here, and we see this in our members, and I think my own company is an example of that, is until you actually have a plan to deliver your commitment, you won't sign up to it. So Zed was not part of the 30 signatories that you spoke about. But again, like Jolie's previous example, since we closed off the snapshot, Zed has now been able to make that commitment and had that verified by the coalition. So I think, again, it's a good example of we want to make sure that we have real integrity around not just our commitment, but the follow through that sits behind that. Because otherwise, we do run that risk of, dare I say it, greenwashing, or just being accused of trying to do something that looks nice, for which we won't ultimately be held accountable.
At the outset, you mentioned the emissions reduction budgets, and you mentioned the government's role in setting policies that impact on business and making them clear and getting them done. The announcements last week have been variously described as deeply disappointing, underwhelming, a grab bag and a hodgepodge. This is the government's draft policy response. Looking at it from the perspective of businesses trying to make actual plans to meet actual commitments, how would you describe what the government's produced so far? Or if you want to be more diplomatic, what is it that you need?
I think clearly, as a nation, we have a higher ambition to address climate change, and we currently have a gap in the pathway to deliver on that goal. So we're currently working through the details of that plan with our members in order to develop a more considered submission. But I think when you stand back from that, government and business need to work in lockstep, and we're ambitious and we're ready to play our part. But what we need alongside that, to your point, is certainty around the policies and the plans, because we're making significant investments. You want to make sure that you understand the policy criteria for which you're doing that against. So I think we're ready to lean in and help to close that gap. And the thing that we need really is more of that certainty around policy.
Mike?
Yeah, I reinforce that. There are some things that businesses are naturally good at, and there are some things that government are naturally good at. I think there's an opportunity to do more together so that we get the sweet spot between what we're naturally both good at. So, for example, I think businesses are generally good at moving quickly in response to changing customer demand. They're good at allocating capital and making long-term decisions. They're good at managing risk. So I think those are the sort of things that are generally useful for governments to put policy into effect. And because we're good at those things, I think we can help shape or contribute to government policy by saying, well, if you went slightly more left or slightly more right on that particular pathway, we would be able to get into action quicker or manage the risks in a way that was more productive to the outcome that you're looking for.
Are you having the conversations you need to have at the moment? Obviously, everybody is distracted by the challenge of a global pandemic, but issues like climate change can't sort of just hang around waiting for the focus to come back on them in some ways. Are you having the conversations that you need to have at the moment, and do you anticipate them in formal processes or informal processes from here?
I think it's a mixture of both, to be honest with you. So, yeah, we've been, as a coalition, we've been really pleased with the opportunity to engage with the Climate Change Commission through a variety of submissions that we provided to them, or indeed the briefings and feedback that we were given. The documents that were released last week provides us with yet another opportunity to provide a submission around that on behalf of our membership. And equally, each individual member is encouraged to go and have their say as well, as you're representing their own company and their own company's interests. So I think you've raised in your question, I think you raised quite a good point. There are both formal and indeed informal ways in which businesses can engage with government and vice versa, such that we get a set of emissions reduction plans that are solid, achievable with the right amount of stretch, and that we can get into action over.
Can I ask you a question about Marsden Point, please, Mike? Because some concerns about its refocusing, it's going to stop its refining capacity unless there is an intervention, actually, probably by the government on some kind of national interest basis. It looks like that's going to go ahead. Two observations. People have said if the pandemic has taught us anything, it's that things that we think unthinkable can happen, and that New Zealand would retain the ability to, I think, about 20% of its fuel is provided, is locally produced crude. We would at least retain the ability to keep trucks on the road, food on the road, police, law on the road in a crisis situation if we were able to do that. But you were also talking about biofuels. And are we missing a trick here if we do not enable capability at Marsden Point to be retained?
Yes, so there are discussions between Refining New Zealand and government, or indeed MB, government department have recently released an interest document around who would like to look at supplying sustainable aviation fuels to Air New Zealand, for which Refining New Zealand, as you say, both the human capability and the kit, as we call it, the infrastructure up there, would be well suited to be, in some respects, repurposed from fossil fuels to be able to take, say, wood waste and turn that into a sustainable aviation fuel. So those conversations are ongoing, which is a terrible expression because it implies nothing's happening. But yeah, there are conversations that are taking place. They are all in the context of the bigger issue around climate change and what's the best way in which government can put policy in place and indeed funding that creates the right incentives for companies to make the investments. That's why it's not just about, I think, Refining New Zealand and the kit up at Whangarei. It's about the overall portfolio of initiatives that the government should be supporting financially and through their policy work.
Thank you. Mike Bennetts of Z Energy and Jolie Hodson of Spark.